First of all, I'd like to thank you for agreeing to take part in the interview. The 21st of April 2008 at Chatham House. First of all, can you just describe what your role has been within the realm of nuclear policy making within the ACCU?
Well, I've served in the Navy for many years and specialised in submarine engineering. And did my usual sort of sea-going stuff and had my first shore appointment to the Navy when I went to part of the nuclear propulsion oversight offices in Bath, where I, as a lieutenant commander and as a promotion commander, had responsibility for preparing a sort of operating handbooks for all the Navy's nuclear plants and for visiting newly fueled submarines and helping with others, although we all had to agree, so it was a power of veto, that the submarine was ready to start up for the first time and the rules under which it did that. So that's not barely policy, but it's sort of on the edge of policy. And then after that I was the project manager for the refit and refuel of the nuclear submarine at Chatham. I was chairman of the Naval Nuclear Technical Safety Panel for Captain in the early 1980s, which involved visiting the Office of Naval Reactors to discuss submarine disposal, which was an interesting subject as the first nuclear submarines were beginning to be decommissioned. I was Director General of Submarines, which included responsibility for nuclear propulsion. In the early 1990s, I became controller of the Navy, which included responsibility for Altmaster's budget as well as the Naval Nuclear Propulsion budget. In the mid-90s, and then for 7 years from 1996, I was the Chief of Defence Procurement with overall budgetary responsibility and administrative responsibility for Altmaster as well as the procurement of nuclear propulsion plants.
So you mostly dealt with nuclear propulsion?
Well, in the first half of my career I did, yes. And then in the second half of my career I dealt with both.
Can we start with propulsion?
Yeah.
Does Britain have a lot of collaboration with the United States with field of propulsion?
Well, it's a very difficult thing for me to answer, really, because it's now 5 years since I left the government service. But the 1958 Mutual Defence Agreement, which provided for cooperation on nuclear business, included the agreement of the United States to supply a nuclear propulsion plant to the Royal Navy. And the genesis of that was a very carefully set up program which was designed, I think, although I can't know because I didn't join the Navy at that stage, but it was designed, I think, to accelerate the introduction into the Royal Navy of nuclear propulsion submarines, because at that stage the Royal Navy had its own prototype nuclear plant under construction at Dounreay. And of course there were difficulties with that, but I mean it was proceeding broadly, satisfactorily, but there had to be a material change, I think, to stainless steel from, I think it was Inconel to start with, and that obviously took put a lot of extra time into the thing. So the purchase of an entire complete nuclear propulsion plant called Type S5W, which I think, I know the W stood for Westinghouse. 5, I think, was just a serial number that reflects the type of design. Mm. The S probably stood for submarine or ship or something like that. So the S5W plant came complete with a nuclear reactor and with alternators to generate electricity and steam turbines and gearbox, the whole works, which you could fit into the back of a nuclear submarine. It was pretty much the same as we've been expecting for from our own prototype program. So that was a huge piece of cooperation. That's where it all started.
In this field of nuclear propulsion, from one of the Gamma Mother sources, Britain seems to do a lot of its work in this field so on its own, and then it correlates its information with the United States after it's achieved where it thinks it's at, and then the Americans sort of mark the homework, so to speak. Would that be a fair reflection?
Well, I have no experience of that. I'd be surprised if that was the case. And I'll explain why in a minute. But first of all, the facts as I understand them, and you know, everybody's got a different view of what the facts are. But my view is that under the 1958 agreement, and effectively under the, therefore the arrangements under which the Dreadnought propulsion plant was provided, it was first of all agreed that it was insisted upon by the United States that this be done under a company-to-company transfer of technology.
Rolls-Royce.
And Rolls-Royce were deemed by the United States to be suitable, but they didn't have all the capabilities. So a company called Rolls-Royce and Associates was set up, where I think Rolls-Royce had 50% of it, and two other companies, one of which was Foster Wheeler. I'm not sure who the others were, but they might have been Babcock, but not Babcock International that we know now, but a boiler company or something. Had 25% each, and Rolls-Royce bought those shares out subsequently. But the key point about that was that the United States deemed Rolls-Royce to be a suitable sort of cooperator, if you like, with Westinghouse, who were the designer, remember the W and S,
yeah.
W, to receive this technology. And I know it's hard for people to appreciate, but the security surrounding nuclear propulsion is extremely rigorous, and always has been. It is an enormously powerful technology, and has allowed many other submarine capabilities, most obviously speed and quietness.
Mm.
And those two capabilities are very strongly linked to nuclear propulsion, as well as availability of the ship, because clearly, if you don't have the fuel, you can stay at sea for as long as the food will last you, provided you're careful enough to make oxygen and all the other things. None of which technologies, incidentally, are very simple. They all go to building up the total capability of a submarine. Anyway, the point about this is that when Dreadnought arrived, or the Dreadnought propulsion plant, the S5W plant, arrived, it included a whole lot of American handbooks. And there was a training package associated with it, so that a number of officers were able to go, and who were destined to be in the Dreadnought crew, were able to go to the United States and either serve in U.S. nuclear, active service U.S. nuclear submarines, to see how it all worked, and also to undertake sort of technical training, if you like, in U.S. Navy establishments designed to train their engineer officers in nuclear technology. And that was a complete package, and it's quite an interesting sort of thing, really. Along with that came a very deep appreciation that the operator was at the front line of safety.
Mm.
And therefore, if you didn't train, if you didn't select and then train and then assess the operators properly, you would not have a capable or indeed an available submarine. I mean, in other words, not just a question, could it reach potential, but did it do it reliably and safely, most obviously. And the American insistence, really, was that after this initial package had been transferred to the UK, I know this more by osmosis, by which I mean I was told it by my then superiors that I ever saw in documents, but my very clear understanding I developed from my time writing operating documentation was that the United States Navy's commitment was to always inform us if there were any safety issues of which we would otherwise be unaware with the treatment plant. I'm not aware that we ever had any particular notifications under that umbrella. But that otherwise we should be largely independent.
Mm.
And you know, you can take whatever view you like of that. You can say, this is Admiral Rickover, who was in many senses the father of nuclear propulsion, but I think may have personally had some qualms about transferring his beloved technology to the United Kingdom. And therefore you could say that what he did was to place a tighter restriction around the agreed diplomatic package, or package agreed at diplomatic level, as he possibly could, without in any sense, so to speak, thwarting the agreed arrangements between his president and the United Kingdom government. So you could take that view that Rickover was being his normal prickly self and saying, well, if that's what they said they could have, then that's what they shall have, and not one,
no, screw,
one screw more. Exactly. I think, I mean, there may be some truth in that. I take a different view, which is that Rickover knew that if you are handing over this technology to another navy, however capable, as the Royal Navy was undoubtedly was, and is, but certainly was in those days, in the view of the United States Navy, however capable it was, it had to set the highest possible operating standards and technical understanding of this plant. Because if it didn't, then something could go wrong, and that would reflect very badly on the United States Navy's ability to continue to pursue nuclear propulsion. And we saw that with Russian nuclear submarines that were always having, well, always the wrong way. There seemed to be quite frequent Russian nuclear submarine accidents, and that, maybe they happened all the time, but they seemed to come along, things like the Kursk.
Yeah.
And there is another, you know, there have been a number of Russian nuclear submarine accidents which are reasonably well documented, and they, maybe they were rushing things, maybe they weren't made properly, maybe the people weren't obeying the procedures, maybe they weren't well enough educated. Whatever the reason, those accidents reflected very badly on the reputation of the Soviet Navy, Russian Navy, as well, in my view, I'm guessing, on the confidence of the crews that were inside the ship. So they had the most terrible days for them, the Widowmaker and all sorts of things they called these things all the time. And you never know if these things are true, but that's the way it works. So my view would be that Rickover, for whatever motive, and the motive almost doesn't matter, you know, you often say judge people by what they do, not by what they say they're going to do, decided that the best way to make sure the Royal Navy behaved responsibly was, so to speak, to cut the apron string attaching it to the US Navy as a source of the design information. So you're on your own. We provide you with all the data you need. We provide you with all the initial training you need. It's now up to you to set up training schemes, to follow our procedures, but you must stand on your own 2 feet. And we will, of course, tell you if we discover anything about the plant that you couldn't expect to know if you were standing on 2 feet. I think that, in effect, served us in extremely good stead because it forced us to become self-reliant. It's rather like a child sort of leaving home, really. If the parents continually solve every problem with money, then where's the incentive for the child to go away and look after itself? And maybe that's rather far fetched now, but I think you see what you're getting at.
That type of argument's exact same argument which a lot of current historians are pushing now, with like Rickover decided America, Britain has to be as good as it can possibly be, but it can't rely on America. It can have the know-how of what Britain's got to them.
I do think that's fair, and it's also true to say that, you know, when I say Rickover's a prickly character, I never met him. I know enough people who did, and I know enough of his reputation to say that that would be a pretty well undisputed view. And it's also true to say that somebody who was of such immense significance in the United States Navy a navy, I mean, of colossal proportions compared to our own, with hundreds of admirals, to find him stuck at a two-star for as long as he was stuck at two-star. I mean, you just know there's something that the Navy find difficult about this person, because otherwise he'd have been a four-star admiral straight off, let alone a three-star. He did make three-star in the end, but it was a terrible struggle. And, you know, he was way past retirement age, and he was still kept as a two-star. Now, that tells me something about him. What I'm not sure, what I meant to check before this interview, which would be a really interesting thing to do, is, has there ever been a US Navy ship named the Hyman G. Rooker? Because if there hasn't, that's telling me something else about who the US Navy regards. It would be a very easy thing to check. Dead easy. It'd just be interesting. And then to see what other animals of his vintage who contributed as significant a thing as that to the United States Navy have had ships named after them. Or secretaries of the Navy or something. Because, you know, the secretary of the US Navy is a very significant person. But, I mean, Rickover was in both the Department of Energy and the Department of the Navy at the same time. So my contention is that he was I've used the word prickly because I don't think there's any point in going any further, but I think he was probably a difficult to handle.
Difficult character.
Very idiosyncratic. Had these extraordinary things where he interviewed people for, nuclear submarine appointments, and if they put salt in their food before they tasted it, he threw them out the rope because they'd made a judgment not based on facts. And that sort of stuff. All of which is pretty apocryphal, but my guess is when you hear enough apocryphal stories about somebody, and they're all consistent.
All
pointing in the same direction. And I think it's also really true to say that, you should be able to independently verify this, but there's a biography written of him, the father of the nuclear submarine, probably in the 1950s. I think that really about school, or about the USS Nautilus. Which explained that he'd come to the United Kingdom. He said he was an electrical engineer, and he was a captain of the United States Navy in around about 1940, or before the United States entered the war, and came to the United Kingdom to get some advice on how to protect ships against damage from mines. And, I haven't read his books since I was at school, I don't think, but I can remember reading in that the Royal Navy then was engaged in a world war, full on. And this US admiral turned up, US captain turned up to demand information about how to protect his ships. And I think he was probably given a slightly shorter shrift than we wished 20 years later that he'd done. So he may have been a man to remember a grudge, and maybe that's not true anyway, but all of those things could be researched. I don't think it would be difficult to do. So it's always interesting how people fought pupils, and if it is right that Rickover came here in 1940, if it's right that he was given a short shrift, and if it's right that the United States Navy really wanted this information, then it's quite possible that the reason that we have this slightly frosty relationship wasn't just his far-sightedness in saying if they don't stand on their own 2 feet, they won't ever really understand the full responsibility of this technology. Maybe it was just all founded because some captain, because somebody was rude to him in 1940, who knows?
He swings on little things like that.
Yeah.
Is Britain there now, do you think, in the field of nuclear propulsion? Does it stand there at all?
Indisputably.
Yeah.
What's interesting is, I don't think there are single causes of many things, so lots of things come together, but the first nuclear submarines we had, including the S5W plant, had to be refueled, or I'm sort of talking about numbers, it depends how much you use them, of course, which depends on how reliable and available they are, but say every 4 years. Yeah. And the fuel that's just gone into or going into the first of the Astute submarines and has been running in our prototype reactor plant at Dounreay now for several years, will last for the whole life of the ship. Now that is a colossal step forward in technology, and it's the same old fissile uranium U-235 atom. So when I said there's no single cause of things, that is getting to understand better how to extract energy from a given number of uranium-235 atoms embedded in the fuel, much of which I would think, or some depends on experience, step by step, evolve the design, continually optimizing it, but it's my guess, maybe it's an informed guess, I think it probably is, that a lot of that has been enabled by the immense improvement in computing power over the last 30 years, which has allowed analysis of the behavior of a core as you operates at power to be predicted immensely accurately. And so whereas this latest core in Astute is still under operation at the experimental plant in Dounreay, it's my sort of instinct rather than knowledge that a future design, of course, should there need to be one, maybe hard to think how I'm making it more cheaply, should there need to be one, you wouldn't need to test a prototype, because these things can now be so well analysed in a computer that you could save yourself the money of building a prototype. They've always more or less conformed to their scientific prediction anyway, but now the ability to predict how these things operate and evolve during their lifetime is it's just orders of magnitude greater than it used to be.
To move it on to the weapons. Mm. Throughout your time in office, power, whatever you want to call it, did Britain benefit from its cooperation with the United States, politically, economically? Not military, because it's not really a military weapon, is it? As I've been told, it's a political weapon, but it may be a war-fighting
vehicle. Well, we won't go down that. No. It's not a rabbit hole. It's into a whole new area of discussion about whether attack on nuclear weapons are military weapons or not. But of course we benefited. And it's true to say that the 1958 agreement really wrapped up cooperation on nuclear matters. I think it was called the Mutual Defence Agreement,
yeah,
which implies a sort of wider scope than just a particular thing. And it had these two elements, really, nuclear weapons and nuclear propulsion, of which my guess is if you asked the average person in military defence, they'd think it was more or less all about weapons. And it's my guess that just as with commonly held assumptions, that is broadly right. The nuclear propulsion was a codicil, or I don't think it's written like that, but I mean it appears to me that there has been far less cooperation or exchange of information and ideas on nuclear propulsion than there has been on the weapons program. You're quite right in saying that I spent most of my early career in nuclear propulsion and nothing in weapons, and it's really when you're at the sort of working level that you understand how things, you know, actually go on. And it's quite interesting that, you know, the United Kingdom has one nuclear weapons laboratory. I mean, it had various outstations, but we have no illusion that Aldermaston was where it all happened. And there were various other places, but none of them were of great significance. I mean, they're just experimental facilities at Shrewsbury Ness and manufacture of certain materials in South Wales and etc. etc. All gone now. It's famous in Aldermaston and the assembly facilities at Burford. And it's quite interesting when you've got a single lab doing something. It's making things start to go off the rails. I mean, it was fine in a testing world. Maybe you would conduct nuclear tests, and if a bang produced the expected effect, you thought you probably understood the design. But I talked about computers and the analysis of reactor cores. Nowhere have computers played a bigger part than in the development of nuclear weapons. We are trying to simulate things that happen in very short intervals of time indeed. And so you sort of hope you're getting these computer codes right and that you understand everything and you substantiate them with immensely complex and you hope properly representational experimental programs to validate these computer models. And in the absence of an underground testing program, well, first overground, then underground, it becomes even more important that you get these models right. Now, the United States has got three national labs equivalent to this. Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore, and there's another one, I think. And they were able to, so to speak, peer review each other's work, although I bet this is a characteristic of all internal organizations, that they probably were very, very grudging in the way they disclosed information to each other, which is good from a security point of view, but you can bet there's always a sort of competition for funds and importance, who's going to do what. And I think the United Kingdom probably had a degree of cooperation, let's put it like this, on nuclear weapons with these US labs, which would be completely unrecognized by anybody who worked in the field of nuclear propulsion. But, I mean, partly that was sort of fostered by the fact that we then got into the Polaris program, or as a result of the Polaris sales agreement, which I think was probably about 1962 or there.
62. Max.
Yeah. So we had a mutual defense agreement, which provides for cooperation on nuclear business, mostly weapons, but included the supply of the Dreadnought Corps. I think that's really how I see it. And then along comes the Polaris sales agreement, which still works today, under which the delivery mechanism, the Polaris missiles, were themselves provided to the United Kingdom. And of course, as soon as you don't have to be a genius to work out that integrating a nuclear warhead onto the front end of a missile requires a certain amount of cooperation and confidence on both parts, that you understand just the structural forces, the weights, the size, the dimensions, all those sort of things. So you're forced to sort of cooperate in a way that probably wasn't true about the way that the nuclear propulsion package was delivered. So I think there was a peer review aspect of it, which was important to us.
Did that benefit the Americans?
Well, I think it did benefit the United States. Although that would be for them to answer, I'm sure they wouldn't. My point about that is that no information exchange program between two countries should ever operate to the benefit of one party and not to the benefit of the other. And I think the United States has from time to time acknowledged the fact, certainly in meetings between officials, that they found the ability to look at an alternative approach a very useful part of their own program. I think you don't want to be marking your own homework in this business.
No.
And people talk about setting up independent safety authorities. There are more independent, in inverted commas, people inside or under the instruction of the military defense that you shake a stick at. And of course they're not independent. They come from the same culture. And I'm not talking about people who are badly behaved or people who, are under the thumb of their boss. My real point is they come from exactly the same culture. So they tend to approach problems in the same way. And the great advantage of being able to bring in somebody who comes from a different culture, as in, say, Los Alamos, is that they don't come with all this sort of UK institutional orientation, is a better word, maybe, than culture. I think it's just a very powerful technique, and we could do the same for them. And probably, but this is a complete guess on my part, it would be easier for maybe Los Alamos to accept a sort of peer review from people at Altamont who were no threat to them whatsoever, than to take the guys out of court to Liverpool, who would say, well, if you gave that to us, we'd get, maybe we'd make a better job of it. And of course, nobody ever wants to hand over their work to somebody else.
No.
So I think, yes, I think it was a benefit to them.
Is it still relevant in the 1958 NDA to Britain nowadays?
Oh, very much.
Yeah, so it's still
Very much so. I mean, I'm outside the circles in which these decisions are taken. You can see that the government has talked about now extending the life of the Trident.
Yeah.
Well, once again, that's a missile, a US missile with British warheads on it. That requires cooperation. That requires the exchange of information. You've read about, well, you may not have done, but the United States traditionally imposes immensely strict rules on the export of defense-related articles and information. I mean, really, very onerous indeed. And this is, I think, genuinely thought it's helping the control of proliferation of weapons. I'm not talking about weapons of mass destruction, I'm talking about anything.
Yeah. Starting.
So they're immensely careful about exporting defense technology. And the other reason they're immensely careful about it is commercial. I mean, why would you... if US taxpayers have produced the sort of technical wherewithal for new weapons, why would you go and release that to somebody unless you were absolutely sure that it wasn't going to be either A, physically used against you, or B, commercially used in competition with your own people? So my guess is that this treaty is absolutely essential to genuine cooperation, because it licenses the exchange of information without subjecting it to the normal defence export controls, because it's specifically there, a mutual defence agreement.
A text written from a Nazi Congress or... on the subject of Trident, should Britain go with a Trident, the new D5, is it D5?
Yeah, well, we've got D5 missiles.
Yeah. Right? What's the upgrade? Should we go for the upgrade?
Well,
it looks like
it's a political issue about whether the country should retain a nuclear weapon capability. That's very much a political decision. But I tell you what, if you decide not to, at some future date, I think you're virtually saying from the moment you announce that decision or promulgate it within the community, you are really sounding the death knell of the existing deterrent. I think it's a very dangerous argument to say we'll retain our existing Vanguard class submarines and Trident weapon system until the end of its life, and then won't replace it. Because I think the moment you say that, well, I mean, the people who work on it will think, well, I better go and find myself another career. That's the first thing. And without the people who underpin every aspect of this, it won't be available, it won't have the same access to expertise that you would expect a system like this. So in a sense, I'm saying, at the moment you take a decision not to replace it, you're really saying a decision that as from tomorrow, I think we're going to give this up. And I don't see how you can, it's consistent with continuing to operate it, to say we won't replace it. So I think the government's always been very clear that part of Aldermaston's duty was to retain the capability to sustain the existing weapon system, and for the long term to underpin Britain's national nuclear capability. What I'm really getting round to is political decision about whether to retain it. But don't think, in my view, there's a halfway house between saying we won't replace it, Trident, we'll just keep it going until the end.
Yeah.
And the other thing to say is that if you ever stop, starting it again is almost unthinkable. Politicians would be as capable of anybody as counting out the number of countries that now have nuclear weapons. And, I mean, deterrence is an immensely fascinating theory to get into, but I just say it's a long time to give it up when lots of other people were getting it.
So unilateral disarmament's a no-go, would that be fair?
Well, I think multilateral argument is a joke as well, because I don't think You know, I think whereas the Soviets and the United States were able to reduce the number, I mean, they had so many.
That's so many to get rid of.
I mean, it's a ridiculous number. I think that's partly inter-service rivalry. You know, if you've got one, I want one too. And actually, if you've got 100, I want 200.
I mean, assault negotiations in the 70s were pretty laughable. I mean,
yeah. But eventually they realized they got so many of these things.
Get rid of soldiers.
And so many delivery mechanisms, and the cost and the people demands of all that are just so colossal. And the risk of losing one or something, you know, I think cutting down the numbers is a good thing. I don't think I'd much care whether I had 1 or 200 bombs dropped on me.
It doesn't really matter.
I don't think it does. The sailors used to have a little sign on the door of some tribal room which said, there are 3 levels of deterrence. Rubble, gravel, and dust. That's a sort of piece of
mentality.
Dark naval humour required to sustain you when you're doing a very serious job, extremely professionally. But the point it makes is it doesn't much matter.
Completely agree, to be honest with you. If we're going to get a newcomer ahead, don't really matter if it's a merged or whatever. It's I want to be dead. I don't know. How important is it actually Britain's deterrent to its overall defence posture when you were in?
Well, it was hugely important.
Yeah.
I mean, during the Cold War, which I spent nearly all my naval career was in the Cold War, we knew the Soviet Warsaw Pact forces were enormously numerically superior in Europe. Brezhnev made speeches in Prague in, I don't know what the date was now, the mid-60s, in which he said, trust me, comrades, you know, one day the future will be ours, or worse to that effect. And which was sort of code for, you know, we are the most powerful people in Europe. I mean, they were producing new stuff all the time. They made submarines out of solid titanium, which is as good a way of bankrupting a country as I could possibly think of. I mean, just unbelievable. They were pouring resources in. I mean, pouring resources into defence. And if they'd chosen to unleash that across the inner German border, I mean, I'm sure we could have slowed them down with conventional force, but often, I mean, it's probably counting the thing, days, not weeks, except for our ability to threaten Russia, not the Warsaw Pact, but Russia with nuclear weapons, if they ever tried that sort of thing. Now, some people say, well, that's just complete nonsense. And to be honest, none of us knows. But my instincts are that if somebody's stabbing your foot and they know you knock their head off with a single punch, they're probably stop stabbing your foot. It's sort of vaguely reassuring to think that we had that behind us. What I've never found quite so persuasive, as we talked about right at the beginning of this talk, was the concept of tactical nuclear weapons, to sort of slow them down with sort of
battlefield use.
My guess is if you're sitting in a bunker in Moscow and you've decided to attack, you know there's going to be lots of people killed in the battlefield. So, you know, if somebody drops a tactical nuclear weapon on you in a battlefield, they'll be off. They just keep going, because it doesn't affect them. The only thing that affects them is whack the power centers of, you know, the people who are making these decisions feel that their whole country has been threatened. So I feel very comfortable with strategic nuclear weapons. I always have. I can't deny that. All those are judgments, and I very much respect them, have a completely different view, and very much enjoy an argument with them.
It's always a good argument. Is Britain's deterrent best served with the submarine launch ballistic missiles?
Well, I'm partly free to that. I mean, I can't deny. I mean, with a naval background and a submarine background, I mean, I first got interested in submarines out of school.
Have a fancy one to be on one.
I love the whole idea of it. You read some of these books about submarines in World War II, they're inspirational stuff. What happened was that the country invested colossal amounts of money in the V-bomb force. And it had 3-4 nuclear bombs. And through the 1950s, probably made great sense as a policy. But it quickly became evident that penetrating Soviet airspace, let alone Russian airspace, with manned bombers, which just wasn't a rash, you know, you couldn't predict. Mm. And getting anywhere near Moscow is just going to be impossible in any reliable sense. Although you can always overwhelm people with numbers, as I think Stalin observed. But it's just not a good way of going about the certainty of nuclear deterrence. So you needed something with penetrative capability and reliability of delivery. I think Skylab is due to do that. And of course, I mean, I don't know really, but I can imagine that the Air Force had these wonderful people, you know, three different types of bombs that did the same. Now they only have got one or something, tornadoes. But we had three different types of people. And the idea of arming with a long-range missile, which I think was called the Douglas Skybolt, was a very natural response to the difficulty of the Air Force delivering the terror. But, of course, all that came to naught. It's a really good lesson. It came to naught, not because we didn't want it, but because the Pentagon cancelled it.
So
you don't want to get into a situation where your ability to sort of determine the strategic posture of your own country is totally dependent on decisions taken a long way away. You want to be very, very confident indeed that a cooperative program has the backing of the other party. And, you know, that's been my experience as Chief of Defence Procurement and before that and other things. For year after year, be really careful about Greeks bearing gifts, which is a sort of metaphor for any other country that comes and invites you to cooperate in a program, because you know that the only reason they're doing that is to get your money, because they're short of money to do it themselves. And if they're short of money, it means it's not achieving the right priority. And if it's not achieving the right priority, then it's vulnerable to cancellation. So I thought the Skybolt's a fantastic lesson for the dangers about cooperating on a development program. What is nice to do is to buy off-the-shelf stuff.
You know it works.
You know it works, and you know that the other people, the counterparty, in this case the United States, is going to keep with it. And if you think of it as US government barcoded product, that is the best description I have of how you know it's going to be okay. Just guess, you don't change anything. There's one discipline that's really paid off in the Navy. It is that our submarines in the missile environment, and in all respects of the strategic weapon system, with the exception of the actual number of missile launch tubes, I think are pretty well identical in every conceivable technical respect to the United States. Like, there is no better example of configuration control that I know of in any industry than the configuration control applied to strategic submarines. And the reason is they have to absolutely conform with their United States counterparts, because they're using the same missile. So if they put a modification in, we have to put a modification in. And if we ever were to be so stupid as to miss a modification, it's like not taking the next upgrade from Microsoft. You're on your own, sunshine.
Yeah.
And you just don't want to go there. You don't want to go there. So we take US government barcode product and we pay the price of membership. It's a continuing price to keep them in sync. So with all that, first of all, do I think the United States will keep it? My first question is, if the submarine is to be right for us, we have to know where we're going to get the missiles from. Do I think the United States will continue with this? Well, they got more of these submarines than we have.
Fair guess.
I think, despite loads of stuff about how submarines are all going to be locatable from space or the seabed or anything, if you listen today,
on the news.
On the news about this ship from China, a tricolour laid weapon. So they can't even say it's a surface ship, for goodness sake. They can't even say whether it's got to Mozambique or Angola.
This one trying to load off its weapons
from Uganda. You're thinking, well, today they were, and I'm talking now, I'm not talking about national defence, giving yourself, but I'm sure that navy's contracted. But it's just interesting to me that a surface ship of that size, as far as the world's media is concerned, have enormous attention to this. They don't know where it is. And the reason they don't know where it is, they say, well, if it switches off its transponders, then how do we know where it is? Well, that is a very interesting insight into how difficult it is to find a submarine whose sole purpose is to remain undetected. So, I think it's a very secure launch platform. I think our counterparties in the Mutual Defence Agreement and the Polaris Sales Agreement will retain a submarine based territory. But if they don't, then all bets are off as far as we're concerned. We can possibly hit ourselves because we don't have the missile technology. And we don't have the money. And it just, things become disproportionate. But at the moment, it's a really good bargain. A really good bargain. They pay the development costs.
Yeah.
They've eliminated the risk. So do I think it's a good idea? If you want a deterrent, I can't think of a better one.
Pretty much concludes it, to be honest with you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Most interesting what you were saying.